Israeli forces arrest dozens of Palestinians across the West Bank amid mounting tensions over the death of five Israelis by a Palestinian man. Over a month into the Russia-Ukraine conflict, Moscow says Kiev has stated willingness to meet core Russian demands. And Iran says Afghanistan deserves more international attention as China hosts a meeting of Afghan neighbors. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The top story this hour, resistance movements heaping their praises on a young Palestinian man who lost his life after killing several Israelis in an operation near Tel Aviv. That's part of the struggle against occupation. Hamas saying the attack was a heroic operation in response to the crimes and acts of terror committed by the Tel Aviv regime. The Islamic Jihad has described it as the price that the Israeli regime must pay for its brutalities and terrorist acts. Meanwhile, a popular Front for Liberation of Palestine has pointed to the operation as proof of a collective Palestinian commitment to resistance. The Al-Aqsa Brigades has also reacted by calling the attack a natural response to Israeli crimes. Following the attack, the Israeli forces arrested dozens of Palestinians across the West Bank. In a statement commemorating the 46th anniversary of the land day in Palestine, the Islamic Jihad movement has praised every Palestinian for defending their land and adhering to it. The movement in Palestine saluted every Palestinian in the West Bank, Al-Quds, and the Gaza Strip, and all the lands occupied in 1948 for their fight against all forms of settlement, annexation, and expansion. The movement has stressed that all attempts of normalization to legitimize the occupying regime will not succeed, adding that conferences, summits, and meetings will not establish a footing for Israel on the land of Palestine. According to the Islamic Jihad statement, the occupation regime still controls more than 85% of the historic land of Palestine and spares no effort to conquer the rest. On March 30th, Palestinians hold rallies in occupied territories to commemorate the protest that day 46 years ago against the Israeli takeover of their lands. Now, moving on, let's go to Ukraine, and let's see what we have the latest regarding Russia's military operation there that's in its second month. A local Ukrainian official claims Russia has shelled Chernihiv despite its pledge to scale back attacks on the city. The Ukrainian military says, however, that Russian forces have started withdrawing from areas near Chernihiv and capital Kyiv. It says the withdrawal might be a bit to mislead rather than genuine de-escalation. Ukraine also claims Russian forces have hit a Red Cross facility in the besieged city of Mariupol. Meantime, the Russian Defense Ministry says the first phase of military operation against Ukraine has been completed. Sergei Shoigu says Russian forces are now focusing on liberating Ukraine's Donbas region after seriously degrading Kyiv's military capacity. That says the UN Refugee Agency says more than 4 million Ukrainian people have fled the country since the beginning of the conflict. Now to diplomacy to end the Moscow-Kiev conflict. Russia's lead negotiator to talks with Ukraine saying that Kiev has expressed willingness to meet core Russian demands. The negotiator added that if Ukraine sticks to its promises, there will be no threat of NATO's expansion to Ukraine. He says Russia's stance on the Donbas region and Crimea remains unchanged. Weeks-long talks between the two sides, including the one held in Istanbul on Tuesday, showed some progress. Moscow has also expressed optimism, saying the discussions on preparing a deal on the neutrality and non-nuclear status of Ukraine were at a practical stage. Russia has also pledged to radically ramp down military activities near Kyiv and Chernihiv. Turkey says that Russian and Ukrainian foreign ministers are expected to meet to advance the talks further.
Peace will have no losers, and a prolonged conflict is not in anyone's interest. This is how Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan opened the face-to-face Russian-Ukrainian negotiations in Istanbul on Tuesday. Erdogan sounded optimistic as he assured Turkey's readiness to host a meeting between the Russian and Ukrainian presidents, whom both he referred to as valuable friends. A Ukrainian negotiator told reporters that they made a series of proposals during the talks to the Russian delegation, which included a demand from Ukraine to have 8 countries as guarantors, including Turkey. While Ukraine can guarantee not having foreign military bases, meaning it would not join military alliances. Ukraine's proposal also includes a 15-year consultation period on the status of annexed Crimea. However, it could only come into force in case of a complete ceasefire.
Ukraine wants to see 8 countries, including Turkey, the US, the UK, France and Germany, as guarantor states to legally actively protect Ukraine from any aggression.
Meanwhile, the Russian negotiator said they will convey Ukraine's suggestions to the Russian president, while describing the talks as constructive. Medinsky later said during the talks with the Ukrainian delegation that Russia is not against Ukraine joining the EU. The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by foreign ministers of the two countries.
Expect a ceasefire upon these meetings, negotiations, within days, maybe through this week, through the end of this week. But this might be a limited ceasefire. I mean, the Donbas region may be out of ceasefire, but at least there will be a positive step through ceasefire. The peace agreement will take some time. The questions are, problems are very big. Donbas and Crimea are something the leaders needed to discuss and agree.
The Russian delegation said a meeting between Putin and Zelensky would only be possible if a deal was sealed by the foreign ministers of the two countries. Meanwhile, the Russian Defense Ministry announced a suspension of all operations around Kiev and Chernihiv after the meeting. Today's meeting was considered constructive, as it will pave the way for deeper negotiations between the foreign ministers of Ukraine and Russia, and hopefully reaching an agreement on a complete ceasefire. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Russia appears to be toughening its stance in response to sweeping Western sanctions. The Kremlin indicates it might demand ruble payment for Russia's main exports. Earlier today, the parliament speaker said that almost all energy and commodity exports should be priced in rubles, with the Kremlin calling it a good idea in the interest of both Russia and buyers. This includes oil, grain, fertilizers, coal, metals, and other key commodities. Last week, President Vladimir Putin ordered preparations to switch payments to ruble for gas sold to unfriendly countries, including EU members. It remains unclear the exact way in which such payments could be made. The Kremlin spokesman says that Russia won't immediately ask buyers to pay for gas in rubles, promising a gradual shift. But the Russian demand has been rejected by Europeans and a group of 7 major economies. They argue it's a clear breach of existing contracts. Now, several European countries are growing more concerned about their energy supplies as a conflict in Ukraine is pushing up gas prices. Germany is preparing for a gas supply emergency in case of a possible disruption to natural gas flows from Russia. A growing number of German companies are also planning to raise their prices over the next 3 months. The energy crisis was intensified after Moscow announced it would receive payments for its gas sales only in rubles. Meantime, the UK is struggling with soaring gas prices, which have increased fertilizer prices for farmers. And that could potentially affect the food supply. The rocketing energy prices in Europe have also affected Spain, raising its annual inflation rate to a record high of nearly 10% in almost 4 decades. Now, just ahead of a meeting of Afghan neighbors hosted by China, Iranian foreign minister says Afghanistan deserves more attention from the international community. Hossein Amir Abdullahian says Tehran and Beijing support independence, national unity, and the rights of the Afghans. According to the minister, Tehran and Beijing are hoping to see a stable and developed Afghanistan that interacts with its neighbors. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi is hosting the 3rd foreign ministerial meeting of Afghanistan's neighboring countries in Tangshi. Iraq's political crisis deepening. The parliament has failed for a 3rd time to elect a new president as a number of political parties boycotted the voting session. Sources saying that only 178 out of 329 MPs were present, far short of the 2/3 quorum required for the vote. The boycott was called by a Shia coalition bloc coordination framework, which involves former Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. The failed votes are seen as a setback to an alliance led by cleric Muqtada al-Sadr that won the October general election. Months after polls, Iraq lacks a new president or prime minister, keeping the country in a state of political paralysis. The parliament adjourned its session until further notice without giving a new date. Iraq's federal court has given lawmakers until next Wednesday to choose a president. If that deadline is missed, new elections will be likely. Now, Pakistan is heading for a political turmoil. The main ally of the government, Prime Minister Imran Khan, has announced it's quitting the ruling coalition ahead of a vote to oust the prime minister. The Mutahida Qaumi movement, which has seven lawmakers, switched allegiance ahead of a parliamentary no-confidence vote. It says its members would vote with the opposition, which has a combined 163 seats. Debate on the motion is due to start Thursday, leaving Khan is scrambling to keep his coalition intact in the 342-member assembly. Pakistan's joint opposition has the requisite numbers needed in parliament to oust Khan and his government. Accusations of corruption and mismanagement have plagued the government amid soaring inflation and unemployment in the country. Imran Khan blames a foreign-funded conspiracy for trying to topple him. Now, France's upcoming presidential election has not generated much interest abroad, but more importantly, not domestically either. The record disinterest renders polls far less reliable and makes 2022 the most unpredictable election in France in recent memory. Rami Mazahari has more from Paris.
France's presidential campaign is officially underway, but many are warning that an election campaign which has been unlike any other could produce totally unexpected results. 10 years ago, it was considered unthinkable that a campaign could be dominated by open Islamophobia, but that's what has occurred in 2022. The lack of serious issues has turned off voters in record numbers. Abstention is now expected to surpass the level set in the 2002 vote, when the far-right National Front shockingly made it into the second round.
I'm not voting because I don't like any of these candidates. If Marine Le Pen makes it to the second round, then I guess I'll be forced to vote to stop her. But this election is just not interesting.
The lack of certainty about how many will actually go vote reduces the reliability of polls. Emmanuel Macron looks certain to make it to the second round, but if left-wing voters do not abstain or cast blank ballots in a common protest vote, Macron could be surprised to face the left's Jean-Luc Mélenchon. The French left is ignored by foreign media and has been left out of the far-right xenophobia of the previous months. In addition to abstention is another issue, a record number of voters who still aren't sure who they'll vote for. It's not hyperbole to say that this is the most unpredictable election in recent memory. A whopping 40% of people who are planning to vote remain undecided. That number is normally around just 25%.
I am undecided. I know that I'll vote because I always do, but right now, I don't know for who. I just don't really believe any of them.
French polling agencies are not just owned by politicians. They are staffed by ex-politicians at the highest levels. That's made them so not credible, the nation's largest newspaper has refused to run any election polls. The first round vote is on April 10th, and the final round is 2 weeks later. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Pope Francis has started individual meetings with different delegations of Canadian Indigenous peoples in Rome. Talks are focused on abuses committed at boarding schools by Catholic priests against hundreds of thousands of Native Canadians for more than 100 years.
Representatives of Canada's three major groups of Indigenous peoples, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis, have held a second meeting with Pope Francis at the Vatican. The Native Canadians are calling for an apology from the Catholic Church over its role in the abuse and deaths of thousands of Indigenous children. At least 150,000 indigenous children were taken from their families and forced to attend Catholic-run boarding schools, where kids were forcibly converted to Christianity, given new names, and submitted to physical, psychological, emotional, spiritual, cultural, and sexual mistreatment at the hands of the clergy. The last boarding school was disbanded in 1996.
The reality being that Canada still hasn't coped with or grappled with its legacy as a colonial entity. And, you know, those schools, they were sort of the front lines or the shock troops of colonialism. Separate separate Indigenous people from our lands and territories, and separate the children from their families, so that we forever break that connection to land.
The Catholic Church has been operating Indian residential schools for Indigenous youth in Canada for more than 100 years. So far, the remains of over 1,400 Indigenous children have been discovered in unmarked graves at the sites of some of these schools, located in a number of provinces across Canada. According to the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, more than 6,000 children died or vanished over the decades that the boarding schools were in operation. Indigenous survivors have said they hope to persuade Pope Francis to become the first pontiff to apologize for the boarding school's abuse.
What we need is we need Canadians, right? We need Canadians, not Indigenous peoples, but Canadians, to hold their churches, to hold their governments accountable. And, you know, for the continued silence from the Pope, it leaves the impression that, you know, by not saying sorry, that says something. By not saying something, it says something.
More meetings between Pope Francis and representatives of the delegations of Canadian Indigenous peoples will follow this week. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Nowruz in Travelogues. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, we are with you with another episode of Nowruz special series. Nowruz has impacted foreign travelers and tourists so deeply that many of them have put accounts on what they had seen in Iran during this ancient feast. Traditions, customs, rituals, and arts comprise a very important part of every nation's culture and special heritage. They, in fact, shape the identity of every nation. The vast land of Iran has a long history and ancient civilization with a variegated geography. In view of this, it has attracted millions of tourists from across the world. Many of these tourists and even merchants have registered their experiences in Iran in the form of books or written and illustrated reports. Although some of these reports and accounts reflect the travelers' subjective ideas, they show a lot of realities. Clearly, Iran has been the focus of colonialist powers because of its geostrategic situation. For instance, during the Qajarid rule in Iran, particularly during the reign of Nasiruddin Shah, many foreign ambassadors traveled to Iran with political and economic purposes. As usual, Britain was the pioneer and dispatched many agents under various titles to spy for the Queen and the British colonial government. These agents scrutinized in every aspect of the Iranian nation to gain the best concessions from the Iranian government. A brief look at these accounts and reports indicates how much the Nowruz traditions and customs have changed during centuries. Nearly none of these travelogues refers to the nature, history, and status of Nowruz among Iranians. They just give what the traveler or politician has observed during his stay in Iran. Thus, some of their accounts include Nowruz customs mainly among countries rather than laymen. Greek historian of the 5th century BC, Herodotus, has touched upon some of the behaviors of Iranian kings like Cyrus the Great, Darius, Xerxes, and so on. He has also pointed to the customs of Iranians in various occasions. He writes, in Nowruz, in Iran at the time of the New Year, the Achaemenid king in his palace with closed doors would wake up before morning and wait. When the sun would spread her first rays, someone would knock at the door and the king would ask, "Who is there?" He would hear, "Open the door, please. I am the representative of Ahura Mazda and I have brought the new year." At this moment, the door would open and a young handsome man would enter, followed by another young man. The latter carried cereals, grains, wheat, barley, and rice in silver cups, and also gold coins to offer to the king. The king would eat from the foods, indicating the divine amplitude and subsistence, and would take from the coins as the sign of wealth and prosperity. Then the doors of palace would open for people, and people would meet their king. They would congratulate the king, receive gold coin, and talk to the king on their hardships and problems. This ritual continued for 6 days, and then the doors of palace would be closed again. Garcia da Silva Figueroa, Spanish traveler who had a trip to Iran during the reign of the Safavid king, Shah Abbas, writes on Nowruz. It is the Nowruz Eve and the king has invited all members of the camp for porridge and rice and has given everyone 10 coins as gift. The attendees held a copper or bronze dish, which they would fill with water and sprinkle it to others. Sometimes they would throw the full dish to one another, hence breaking the heads of many of them and killing some others instantly. Russian merchant Fedot Afanasyevich Katov, who had come to Iran in 1624, writes in his memoirs, "People in Nowruz would break red eggs and kiss one another. They would spread carpets in rooms and gardens and put expensive items on them. Everyone covers their shops with plaster and decorate them with flowers. In the morning, all shops and houses light candles and small lamps and adorn them with flowers. Businesses were closed in these days and there were only games and different performances at squares. At the enclosure of the palace, a few people would wrestle to entertain the guests. Acrobats, clowns, and jugglers would play their arts, and at times there was the bullfight or sheep fight." French tourist of the 17th century, Jean-Pierre Chardin, also writes in his travelogue on Nowruz customs in Iran. Iranians, reminding their ancient traditions, would gift painted eggs to each other on the eve of Nowruz. Iranians believe that the egg is the source of generation, life, and creatures. The king gifted some 500 eggs to his wives. The eggs were in a closed golden box and decorated with four miniature drawings. The king sat at the table among the royal women who were plunged in jewels, and they conversed warmly. Then musicians and singers entered upon the king's order and entertained the attendees. In another room, the court astronomer was trying to estimate the exact moment of the start of the year. As soon as he gave the news of the turn of the year, firecrackers were set off and court maidens cried out of joy. At that moment, the guards of palace declared the news with gun and cannon shots. A group was also beating drums and long-necked horns. Chardin then writes on Nowruz among ordinary people. Iranians look at water at the time of the turn of the year. This means that water brings light and it will make the individual happy till the end of the year. A few verses of the Quran are recited and everyone drink water and rose water in new clothes. They congratulate the elderly relatives and friends and distribute sweets. They also give alms among the poor and descendants of the Prophet. Dinner has been prepared at homes and everyone exchange gifts and visits. This French tourist also writes that Iranians cover jars with fresh green sprouts, which are delightful to the viewer.
Tümen. Yani?
Bazaar.
The world's first electric elevator was built by a German inventor nearly 150 years ago, marking the beginning of the world's history of the electric elevator industry. But the idea of using lifting mechanisms dates back to more than 10,000 years ago. The first known lifters were in fact wells. Elevators and escalators have had a big impact on modern architecture and design. Through the innovation of these two travel systems, we are able to effortlessly move through multiple levels quickly. This technology has changed the way we travel through the buildings we encounter every day. Hello everyone, and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This week we will be talking about Iran's elevator and escalator market. We wanted to see how this industry is doing nationally and internationally. But before we get to that, we wanted to see just how much work goes into making these items and who the major players in the domestic field are. Plus, we will uncover this sector's contributions to related trades and the economy as a whole. So stay with us and let's get started. To familiarize ourselves with how elevators are made, we visited the production facilities of Behran Asambar in the industrial town of Parand near Tehran. With over 30 years of experience, it specializes in making elevators, escalators, and industrial lifts. It also manufactures lift gearboxes and gearless motor drives, as well as other important parts. This company has made a name for itself through products that create harmony between a practical and aesthetic design, which also offers safe and quiet rides for passengers. This company has implemented hundreds of projects, many of them you probably have already heard of. Some of these are Imam Khomeini International Airport, Tehran Subway System, Iran's Parliament, and the list goes on and on. From its humble beginnings, this company has expanded its manufacturing over the years and now has a production hall with an area of over 110,000 square meters. In addition to manufacturing full lift and escalator packages, this company provides its 14,000 customers of various types with parts and components. Moreover, it is a trusted representative and agent of some known foreign brands as well. Among its many services, this company offers consultations, installation, and after-sales services to its customers. Roughly 1,200 people are employed at this company. Many of them are experts in designing products that seemingly integrate with any project's unique environment. Here is a fun fact about elevators. Each day, elevators move around some 330 million passengers around the world. In other words, all elevators combined together carry the equivalent of the Earth's entire population every 3 days. This also means elevators and escalators are more frequently used than other forms of transportation. That is why their demand remains high, both nationally and internationally. While this company is broadly known inside Iran, it is internationally active as well. It has official representative offices in Iraq, Syria, and Armenia, as well as permanent international offices in countries including Oman, UAE, Germany, and Turkey. But that's not all. This company has implemented hundreds of large projects in several countries, including Azerbaijan and other neighboring nations. The quality control department at this business holds the pulse of the company. Here, new products are designed and existing products are improved on. One of the most important activities in this department is quality control. The output of all stages of production undergoes stringent quality controls that begin with checking the raw material. This includes repeated safety checks to ensure nothing goes wrong with the final product. It also has a test tower with necessary knowledge-based mechanisms for testing its various packages and parts. This company received its operation license from the Ministry of Industry. Additionally, it has received certificates from the National Standard Bureau as well as other international standardization organizations. Among its future goals, this knowledge-based company is planning on expanding its product portfolio as well as its export market. Over the years, this company has faced numerous challenges to enjoy its many achievements. One such obstacle has been the U.S.-imposed sanctions. It has viewed this issue as an opportunity to strengthen its business and fill a market void. Probably the biggest customer of the escalator and elevator industry is the construction sector. Demand for this industry is largely based on trends in the construction sector and downstream activity. Companies such as the one we just mentioned have indigenized productions of lift technology and reduced dependency on imports while saving the country billions. The electric elevator industry in Iran is roughly 80 years old and began when the first oil refinery was built in the southern city of Abadan. And now, this sector is thriving. The Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industry says the country has the capacity for producing and commissioning 80,000 elevators annually. But only 25,000 units are currently produced each year due to the stagnation of the construction industry. The highest level of elevator production and installation in the country was recorded in 2014. This was mainly due to the boom in the construction of Meh housing units. The project was a large-scale construction program that was launched in 2007 to provide 2 million low-income Iranians with housing units. During the heyday of this massive nationwide project, nearly 75,000 new elevators were installed. Such productions pushed Iran to be ranked as third in the world in terms of elevator demand after the United States and China. That's all based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries.
There are plenty of construction projects being carried out all across West Asia. The government has targeted neighboring countries to increase its elevator market reach. Some of these countries include Armenia, Iraq, and Syria. Parallel to this, it is also supporting ways to strengthen the infrastructure for increased production of elevators and escalators.
Towards this goal, the government is encouraging collaborations between research institutions and other knowledge-based companies in this field. By increasing technical know-how through scientific research, companies can stay up-to-date and relevant in the highly competitive market. Right now, the domestic demand for elevator and escalator sales and installation stands at roughly 50,000 per year. Presently, there are a total number of 750,000 operating elevators in the country, which move around 250 million people daily. That's based on the Iranian Syndicate for Elevator and Escalator Industries. On another note, Tehran's subway system is the biggest consumer of escalators in the country. However, many of the lifts and escalators in the system need to be upgraded or overhauled entirely. Currently, about 1,200 escalators are active in various subway stations across the capital. While Iran is a major producer of elevators, it still needs to further develop its escalator productions as most of its technology is still being imported. All things considered, there is so much investment potential in this thriving sector, which promises a bright future.
All right, everyone, it's time for me to pass it over to my dear friend and colleague out there on the field who has prepared an interesting feature for you. Let's go check it out.
If you live in a tall building and not on the first floor, you're likely to use the products we're about to introduce. The products that grant equal access to people who are on different levels and have varying degrees of physical ability. So let's get right in and learn about elevator parts.
In the manufacturing of every elevator, various factors should be considered, such as the height of the building, the number of the people traveling to each floor, and expected periods of high usage. All elevators, however, consist of similar parts.
It's said that necessity is the mother of invention. Not having elevators back when even the tallest buildings didn't have more than a few floors was already a concern. But with the rise of modern buildings, it quickly became a necessity.
One reason we dare use elevators is that we don't worry we're risking our lives in doing so, even if the elevator happens to fall. And that is largely thanks to two elevator parts, the governor and the progressive safety gear, also known as the parachute.
The governor manufactured by this company was the very first one in the country to meet the required standards. The first specialized elevator part manufactured by this company was the lift door opening magnet, and they're now well on their way to manufacture the rest of the required parts.
Iron and cast iron sheets make up some 60% of the materials used here. And this CNC press brake machine is programmed to shape and prepare these sheets for the desired application.
Some 90% of what's required for manufacturing is made right here in the country. The basics of elevator manufacturing haven't changed much for decades. What has changed, however, is the systems that control their speed and safety.
Here, the press machine punches and cuts the iron parts to prepare them for the later stages of welding and painting.
Thanks to their after-sales services and lifetime guarantee on their already high-quality products, the company's market share in the country is now at 70%. But the managers aim to go far beyond the national market and increase their reach. They plan to set up their manufacturing in other countries such as Syria.
Like the people living on different floors of a tall building, different countries do not enjoy the same access to resources. It's the use of ingenuity in industries, however, that can elevate any country, no matter where it started from.
Considered to be the biggest sector in the world in terms of dollar value, the oil and gas sector is a global powerhouse. It uses hundreds of thousands of workers worldwide and generates hundreds of billions of dollars globally each year. The largest volume of products coming out of the oil and gas industry are fuel oil and gasoline. Oil has been used as fuel for transport to generate electricity that lights homes and run factories and machines. And petroleum is the primary material for numerous chemical products, including pharmaceuticals, fertilizers, solvents, and of course plastics. Our lives would be very different without oil.
This time, we're going to explore technology and engineering related to the oil and gas industry. We wanted to see who the major players in this field are and why their services are so complex and unique.
Our journey took us to a knowledge-based engineering company called Farazan Saze Darya, which began its work over a decade ago. Its main activity is to design and build structures related to oil and gas extraction and transfer. It has a broad scope of engineering services, The things it designs encompass onshore and offshore oil platforms, storage tankers, distribution pipelines, and other structures and buildings related to the oil and gas industry. Just like the structure or facility, oil infrastructure is also susceptible to earthquake damage, particularly in southern Iran, where tremors are more common. This firm was among the first engineering companies to implement the new government standards for earthquake-proofing oil platforms and rigs both in and off land. This company has a long portfolio of projects it has engineered over the years. One such project was to create oil tankers and pumps for the strategic Jask oil project. This is a project that transfers oil through a 1,000-kilometer pipeline along the southern coast to the Jask oil terminal. It is predicted that after completion, this project will have the capacity to transfer up to 1 million barrels of crude per day. However, that's only one of the projects that this company has completed, and there are dozens more. Previously, such services were imported into the country. This means that when a new oil platform was needed or an old one needed maintenance, industry participants had to employ foreign companies to come to Iran and get the job done. Among other complications, this process was expensive and created a dependency on foreign services. One of the major advantages of this company is it has localized this specialized engineering service in the country. Indigenizing and employing domestic know-how in the oil industry has helped the country save millions over the years. This company has developed such that now it exports its engineering services. It also collaborates with foreign firms to build and design structures. This firm has created hundreds of employment opportunities, particularly in specialized field of engineering in the gas and oil sector. It has also indirectly generated numerous jobs through subcontractors and construction execution. It is no surprise that this knowledge-based firm has gathered some of the most experienced experts in the industry at its facilities. Among its many activities, it also cooperates with numerous universities and academic institutions. Such steps are necessary for this company to stay up to date. Plus, it incorporates and applies cutting-edge technology in the design and implementation of its projects. This company adheres to strict international standards for designing and building its structures. With years of experience and numerous foreign contracts under its belt, this company has been able to expand its know-how for executing projects with the highest quality. Here is a fun fact you might not have known. With rich oil reserves, Iran is one of the founding members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC. Based on figures from OPEC, the country is the fourth largest oil producer among its members. Plus, Iran possesses the third largest oil reserves in the world. Iran's oil sector will be the first to benefit from the removal of sanctions. Foreign companies remain interested in this market as they anticipate its largest potential. But the road to Iran's market has been obstructed by U.S.-imposed sanctions. Based on figures from OPEC, nearly 80% of the world's proven oil reserves belong to member countries. The majority of these reserves are located in West Asia, amounting to some 64% of the OPEC total. Iran has over 156 billion barrels of proven oil reserves as of 2019, which is roughly 9% of the world's share. Going off of OPEC statistics, Iran produced nearly 3,000 barrels of oil per day on June 2021. Production figures would be much higher if it were not for sanctions imposed on Iran by Washington. Iran's oil industry has faced heavy sanctions since former U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the nuclear deal in 2018. According to the Ministry of Oil, the average daily production of oil before the reimposed sanctions was over 3 million barrels per day. The government has plans to surpass the pre-sanctions production levels to over 4 billion barrels per day. That's, of course, under the stipulation that the sanctions against oil companies and exports are removed.
As you might know, Iran's oil industry is a major engine behind the country's economic growth. Oil exports generate millions in foreign revenue, but the country also uses this valuable resource in other industries to make various products. Petroleum and petrochemical products, such as plastics, are also derived from oil and natural gas, and Iran makes a large amount of both.
Figures from the Iranian National Plastic and Polymer Industrial Association show that Iran can potentially export $5 billion worth of petchem products. Currently, over 6 million tons of polymer products are domestically produced every year. Another derivative of crude oil is gasoline, and Iran completely supplies its domestic needs with its daily productions. In the past year, due to reduced internal usage, much of the surplus was exported to international markets. Based on the National Iranian Oil Products Distribution Company, last year nearly 700,000 barrels of gasoline fuel were produced each day. Data from this company shows that Iran has managed to boost its gasoline exports despite sanctions. Over $1 billion worth of gasoline was exported in the first half of last year alone. That's higher than the year 2020, when Iran exported nearly $500 million worth of this commodity.
We are almost out of time for this program, but before we go, let's check out some news and trends regarding this industry and its related trades. A knowledge-based company has managed to design and engineer one of the vital components used in elevators that were previously imported.
It is a gearless elevator motor. This item was designed by an electrical engineering professor at Yazd University, who is also the head of a knowledge-based company. The product has already received its commercialization license, and the company is set to produce over 500 of these motors annually.
Another product indigenized recently in the elevator industry was manufactured by a major company in the steel industry in Isfahan province.
Presently, this company manufactures elevator guide rails among its other products. Project managers say this is the highest value added to any of the products made at its facilities. Before its mass production, this item was imported with a hefty price tag attached. The developers say productions have saved elevator and escalator industry participants about $200 million in foreign exchange.
These days, research and development centers are facilitating the rise of productivity in various industries. A new product that has been created recently is a super accurate welding machine.
This machine uses laser technology, which offers precise cutting and engraving to its user. The high density of the laser light can heat the surface to the boiling point in a matter of milliseconds so that it completes the welding task quicker. It also leaves a clean finish compared to other traditional welding machines.
And with that, we wrap up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team of Bazaar, thank you for tuning in, and I'll see you next time for another edition of Bazaar.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.